compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and happy Taco Tuesday to you. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, where the number always is 888-914-9149. That's the on-air number. We can get you on the air with your question or comment. If you need a second opinion, you're looking for some, I don't know, advice, could be apologetics, whatever it might be, feel free to give me a call, 888-914-9149. I've got a lot of things I want to get to, but we also have a lot of people holding. Why don't we go to maybe the most recent caller, Mary, listening in Sorrento, Florida. I've been to Sorrento, Italy, but I've never been to Sorrento, Florida. What part of the state is that in, Mary?
It is north of Orlando, so it's Central Florida.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, welcome aboard.
Thank you. I appreciate all that you and Relevant Radio do for us, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Today I'm calling with a question, you're welcome, about the Eucharist and receiving it. My son's fiance has a condition where she can't digest sucrose, so no sugar, no gluten. Mm-hmm. And so actually they're getting ready to be married. So she received her sacrament of communion about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. But she hasn't been able to take the host because of what it contains. So it's on my heart, and I just want for their wedding for her to be able to receive if possible.
Yeah.
So if you have any ideas, I know they have gluten-free, which is made of rice, and she can't take that either.
No. Let's start there. Let's start there. Okay. The only valid matter for the Holy Eucharist is unleavened, and this is in the Latin Rite Church, is unleavened wheat bread with nothing else added to it. So it can't be rice, it can't be anything other than unleavened wheat bread. No butter, no cornstarch, nothing. Okay. So that's just kind of a baseline. Now, as you pointed out, I mean, there are low gluten hosts. They can't be gluten free and still be valid, because in order for it to be valid, it has to be wheat. And if you have something that was wheat, but all the gluten is removed, it's no longer technically wheat. So the low gluten hosts still have a little bit of gluten in them. Now, two questions arise. One would be, does the same physiological response occur if she has the precious blood instead of the Holy Eucharist?
Yes, because there's sugar in wine.
Okay, so that leads to the next, and not really a question, but the next suggestion then. And that would be, obviously, there will be some discomfort perhaps, or some cost, I'm not sure of the right word, for her to receive Holy Communion under either kind. But even if she were to receive a tiny, tiny little particle of the host or a very small droplet of the precious blood, she has still received all of Jesus' body, blood, soul, and divinity. No matter how large or small the piece or the sip of the precious blood in that case. So if I were her dad, I would say, I understand, honey, that having this is going to involve some physical cost, but is it possible, could you just have a very, very tiny, tiny amount, and we'll ask the priest ahead of time for that for you? I'm sure he'll say yes. What do you think her response would be?
I've talked to her about it. She's 26, so she's a grown woman.
I hope so, if she's getting married.
She goes into like a paralysis that's pretty severe, but I think there is a borderline, like a one gram, or there's a point. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking, just, you know, like is it the Viacom when you're a little piece of the host?
Well, the Viaticum, is that you what know? You mean? That's just a phrase in Latin that means to go with. And that's a phrase that's used to describe giving somebody who's dying or near death, giving that person Holy Communion as part of their preparation. But it doesn't have anything to do with the amount of the host or the precious blood.
Okay. I was just thinking, like, when you're really sick and you can't take the whole host because you're passing away, and they give you a little piece. So I will offer that to her and see if so that's helpful, and that you know, compounds what I was thinking. Also, I was wondering, since she's received, and you know, the priest blessed her with his hand, but she didn't receive.
I'm not clear. What's happening? The priest blessed what with her?
His hand? So when she got her sacrament, she received her sacrament of the Eucharist, she didn't physically receive the Eucharist. So does that mean that she really hasn't received Jesus since she's received her sacrament?
So when she was a little girl and her class made their first Holy Communion, she went up but didn't receive anything and never has?
No, she only was baptized. And then just recently she received her other sacrament as a woman.
Okay.
But at that point she was under this condition, so she couldn't ingest the host. So does that mean, I don't know if you know the answer, but...
Well, I want to make sure I'm clear on what you're saying. Okay, there are two questions that have come up now. So at some point from the time after she was baptized, at some point she did physically receive the Holy Eucharist at some point, right?
Yeah, about 2 years ago, she received her sacrament of the Eucharist.
Okay, good. And she actually physically consumed the host?
No. No,
she did not.
Because of this physical condition of the paralysis.
So this is what I'm trying to sort out for you, Mary. If she never actually received either the host, we're talking obviously consecrated host at Mass, if she never received either the host or even just a sip of the precious blood at any time ever, then she has not received her sacrament. So even if she went forward and the priest gave her a blessing, she did not receive that sacrament. It has to be physically consumed, even if it's just a very tiny little portion. Okay. Now that leads to another issue. She could get a dispensation and probably would get, I would think the bishop where you live, I don't know, I guess that might be the Diocese of Orlando, might give her a dispensation, but under ordinary circumstances, the sacrament of holy matrimony is for people who have received their other sacraments of initiation. So that would include, obviously, baptism and confirmation. I haven't asked you about that. And also receiving the Holy Eucharist. So at some point, she would need to receive either or both of those if she hasn't already. You see what I mean?
Yes. So she received her Holy Eucharist and reconciliation and confirmation all at one time.
Okay, but she did actually receive the host into her mouth?
No.
Then that's what I'm saying. Then she didn't receive Holy Communion.
Repeat all of those. So she would have to repeat.
No. Mary, listen. If she was validly baptized and she already was validly confirmed, then all she needs to do is to receive Holy Communion. So unless I'm misunderstanding you, if you're saying that she never in her life even once received into her mouth and actually swallowed either a little piece of the host or maybe a small sip of the precious blood, if she never did that physically ever, then she hasn't received that sacrament. So getting a blessing from the priest, that's nice, but that's not the sacrament. So my advice would be, if I'm understanding the situation correctly, just help her to make arrangements to receive Holy Communion. And I think the way to do this would be the smallest possible portion. And she can talk with the priest ahead of time and make him understand her situation. I'm sure he'll be happy to help her. A little tiny drop of the Holy of the precious blood or a little tiny piece of the host would suffice.
Okay. And then every time afterwards, she would just have to ask the priest, go up to the sacristy before Mass and explain her.
Not necessarily before Mass. So at her parish, let's assume she's a registered parishioner. So she would she would need to just talk with the parish priest and explain her situation. Again, I'm very confident that he would say, no problem. We're happy to make an arrangement for you. Now, I'll leave it at this, Mary. At my parish, there are some people who have to have those low-gluten hosts because they have celiac disease. And so when they approach the communion rail, we have a communion rail, their arrangement with the priest is that they come up at the very end. So they wait till everybody's gone to communion. Then they come up, and the priest knows who they are. There may be two or three of them that I might see at any given Mass. And he has a special ciborium that looks a little different from the other one. It's smaller. And in that, he has the consecrated hosts that have minimal gluten. So he can give them Holy Communion that way. So it's easy to do. I have a feeling, I just don't think that there's any other solution for her to be able to receive. She has to physically do it. So, Mary, I hope that's helpful to you, and thank you for unraveling that for me. A very interesting case, to be sure. Let's go to Saul now in Chicago. Good morning, Saul.
Good morning, Pat. I just wanted to address an issue related to, you know, connection between the body and the mind regarding, say, you know, at one extreme, like demonic possession, at the other extreme, like saintliness, whether, you know, a physical purity in terms of not being taxed or infected with, pathogenic organisms invading, you know, vital organs like the brain, the liver, kidneys, and so forth, you know, like through leaky gut syndrome or different parasites, different,
all right, so let's slow it down for me, Saul. Slow it down. Can you restate this in the form of a question so I can understand what you're asking me?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, is there a connection between, say, spiritual states and, health of, the organic health of the person?
Okay. I think I understand now. So I'm sure you've heard the term psychosomatic, and that is just a combination of two Greek words that means soul and body, and the way in which your soul, which is immaterial, and that would include your mind, which is centered in your brain. That's the physical connection between your body and your soul in terms of your thoughts and ideas and things. There's a definite correlation between your moods, your general mental health, and your physical health. And one example of that I'm sure we're all familiar with is comfort food. So you know how comfort food, we call it comfort food because it makes you feel kind of good, you know, even if it may not be good for you, depending on what your comfort food of choice is. But that's at a really basic level. Comfort food has an effect on your morale or on your mood, that kind of thing. So if that's what you're asking, yes, there is a connection, but it would depend now upon what specific thing you're referring to. So you mentioned the leaky gut syndrome. I couldn't begin to tell you. I don't know. I have no medical knowledge at all. So I couldn't begin to tell you if that condition per se is in any way affected by your mental well-being. I don't know. That would be a question that a doctor could answer. But I can say, just to repeat myself for a moment, that there is an effect on our bodily feelings and emotions and things. Our bodily, how we feel bodily based upon our emotions and our mental state. So there is definitely that connection, but how far it extends, it's hard to know. I think that would be a better question for a doctor.
Yeah, for example, I'm thinking like eating, like you said, comfort food and mm-hmm. A nice bowl of ice cream or whatever, and so that it'll actually help insulate one's cells, like the Schwann cells that kind of cover the neurons and help insulate it.
Yeah, those things, that's deeper water than I can go into, Saul, because now you're asking about, like the biological science, and I just don't have those tools to help with. So that would be my suggestion, Saul. I would recommend maybe touching base with your physician. I have a feeling that he or she would be able to give you some more specifics on that. Thank you for the call. I really appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you know all about comfort food. We all know about comfort food. And
some people say I'm an expert.
Maybe your wife says that about you. So I'll share my example with you. I have lots of different comfort food. That's one of them. That is one of them. I do feel good about tacos. I think I've made a lot of people feel good about tacos who didn't necessarily care about them one way or the other before they heard this programming.
That's fun.
You may be one of them.
Ice cream is my comfort food, but I'm really good about staying away from it 99% of the time. But then when I fall, oh boy, I fall hard.
So is that you in the corner with a half gallon of ice cream and a big serving spoon?
Yeah, my back is, to the room. I'm in the corner and like someone gets close. I'm like, get away from me. I'm eating my ice cream.
Leave me alone.
Lay off me. I'm starving.
All right. Well, there is no doubt that comfort food is called comfort food because it has that effect on us. So isn't it interesting how our body and souls react to each other?
Oh, yeah.
And influence each other.
I'm a stress eater. I'll go home and I'll be like, I'll do good all day at work. I'm eating good food, just, healthy food. And then my plan is to go home and eat healthy. And then I get home and the kids are screaming and everything's on fire, and I go right to the pantry.
And the ice cream is right there in front of you.
I go right to the ice cream.
Yeah.
So, no, usually the ice cream I'm pretty good at. I don't buy it. That's the secret.
I hope you don't steal it. How do you get the ice cream if you don't buy it?
Don't get the ice cream. That's the secret to not eating it, is don't buy it in the first place. So if it's not in the house,
I can't have it, I don't want it.
if I don't want it, nobody's getting it.
Yeah. So how is it then that you have ice cream in your house?
We don't. It doesn't last. It doesn't last.
I know why it doesn't last.
Yeah. But so the secret, just don't buy it in the first place.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if sugary drinks are your, or in your, as people like to say, in your wheelhouse. That's such a trendy thing to say nowadays. Mm. The Irish News has an article about sugary drinks, and that sugary drinks, that would be things like juices and soft drinks with sugar.
Coca-Cola, Pepsi, yeah. Mountain Dew.
Guess what they found in this study?
Pounds of sugar.
Well, drinking two or more of those sugary drinks, they say, could increase the risk of bowel cancer among women under the age of 50. Now, I think you're not in that population. Researchers found that each daily serving was associated with a 16% higher risk. Replacing sugar sweetened beverages with artificially sweetened drinks, coffee or milk, actually led to a lower risk of the disease, according to the study. A team of researchers from the U.S. examined data from the Nurses' Health Study, a study tracking the health of nurses and various lifestyle factors over time. And this was a cohort of 95,000 women who were studied. And they were studied over quite a long time. They reported their consumption levels every 4 years. So this was sort of a long-range study. They would report on their sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Around 41,000 of these women also had data of their sugary drink consumption in adolescence based on previous surveys. The team found, I know this is what you're most interested in, the team found that during the follow-up period, there were 109 cases of early-onset bowel cancer found among the study participants, meaning that they were diagnosed under the age of 50. The study published in the journal Gut. Do you subscribe to that journal, Cyrus?
I've never even heard of that journal.
Gut. It's spelled as it sounds, Gut. I can't imagine what the cover picture would be. Gut. The latest issue. In this issue of Gut magazine. I've never even heard Gut magazine. I think that's brilliant. In this issue of Gut magazine, we have an interview with a guy who sits in the corner and eats ice cream. Where am I? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I want to get a hold of that. Can you get me a copy of that magazine? I just want to see what it looks like.
I'll get you a yearly subscription.
I might submit an article to them. about somebody I know. So could you please post that? Sugary drinks. Yep. sugary drinks.
Well, that's scary. I mean, on my way to school when I was a kid, I passed a 7-Eleven, and I'd get a big gulp. It was like the big, not two yeah. gallons, but it was the big gulp, and then I'd get another one on my way home. Gross.
Filled with what? With Coke or
yeah,
what was
so
your...
I would do the Coke and Mountain Dew. I'd do the mix.
Oh, you'd mix
I'd mix
them.
It all the oh so gross. Oh, it turns my stomach even thinking
mutant.
About it. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I can't believe I survived.
Well, back in the day, and we'll leave it at this, but back in the day, my beverage of choice when I was a kid were Slurpees. Did you ever have a Slurpee?
Oh yeah, I love them.
They were great. I haven't had a Slurpee in a million years. Okay, we will stop, cleanse our palates, and return to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. The number is 888-914-9149. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, longer. Let's do it.
Oh, see, Cyrus knows how much I like this movie. I just...
Know your audience. You're my audience.
And this music is brilliant. There's a great scene at the beginning of the movie. The movie's called Tombstone. And it's not age appropriate for everybody, FYI. But there's this great scene toward the very beginning. It's at the very beginning of the movie where Wyatt Earp shows up in town. And, I mean, you don't see this kind of, I don't know what the right word for it is, manly. People will probably make fun of me for saying manly. Masculine, virile. I'm not entirely sure what's the right word to use. Somebody somewhere will make fun of me for whatever word I pick. But in any case, whatever the right word is, he rolls into town. He gets off the train. He's basically just showing up in Tombstone. And he hears a ranch hand mistreating a horse. And he's like, he's whipping the horse and the horse is whinnying and... So he just like walks over and grabs the rope out of the guy's hand and then like smacks him across the face. And I don't endorse that. I'm not suggesting that you go out and be violent. That's not the point here. But he basically stops the situation. He steps in. He doesn't say to the guy, hey, that's really mean. You shouldn't do that to that horse or anything like that. He just steps in and puts an end to it. He puts a stop to it. And
forgive me if I don't shake hands.
Wrong character. That's Doc Holliday.
Picky.
I know
picky.
All of the lines. I do.
If
but
I
what
thought
I'm saying,
you were my friend, I just don't think I could bear it.
I could do Doc Holliday.
Patrick
than...
Madrid loves this movie.
I do.
As much as he loves tacos. I want to say
I think that's fair. I also think it's fair to say I love that movie as much, if not more, than you love Star Wars. And that's saying a lot.
That's crazy talk. Yeah.
No, it's true.
Yeah, that's crazy talk.
Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. There's that scene, and there's something about it that I find very interesting and compelling in the sense that you don't see that too much anymore. And again, I'm not talking about violence. I'm transcending the fact that he grabbed the rope out of the ranch hand's hand and kind of whacked him on the face. And he says, hurts, doesn't it? You know, like, stop mistreating that horse. So just that's all. There's a little value lesson, if you ask me there, about comes a time in every man's life, and maybe many times, where you have to get in and fix something. You have to get in and put yourself between the problem and the person you're protecting, for example. I can think of one example, Cyrus. If you don't mind, I'll just share this with you.
Isn't that a daisy?
Yeah. I'm your Huckleberry. So, and all the Tombstone fans are going to start sending messages on Twitter asking for particular scenes. So Cyrus must have his hands on a soundboard. He's going.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah.
What gave you that idea?
I don't know. I just intuition, I guess. So, I mean, I have five daughters. They're all grown up. Let me think. Three of them are married. And back in the day when they were young women and unmarried, I remember there was one of my daughters had a kind of boyfriend, but not really a boyfriend, but kind of a boyfriend. And I thought that this guy was bad news because I found out because I had given them some instructions and I had told him to his face, you know, don't be alone together. Don't be in a, you know, in a room together alone where there's nobody else. And I found out that he intentionally, willfully disobeyed that rule. And I'm the dad and I make the rules. And that's how it was. So, and of course, the rules were for the benefit of my daughters and to help and protect them. But in any case, when I found out that this guy was intentionally disregarding some basic requirements that I had laid down and I expected him to observe, I had to have a confrontation with him. Now, this guy was very interesting. He was very well spoken. He would have made a great salesman. I mean that. He would have sold anybody anything. And maybe he went into sales. But in any case, he tried to sweet talk me and he tried to hustle me and he tried to, you know, basically schmooze his way out of the situation. And it got down to the point where I said, you are not allowed to go out with my daughter anymore. And he said words to the effect, he says, well, maybe you'll never know. Like maybe I'll date her behind her back, behind your back, and you'll never know. And I said, well, here's the missing ingredient, my young friend. And that is, I love my daughter and my daughter loves me. And my daughter will tell me if that type of thing goes on. So basically, Sarge, I had to run this guy off. And there was never any even hint of any kind of like physical aggression. It was nothing like that. I'm not trying to suggest that I was a tough guy or because it wasn't like that. But this guy wanted to run me over. He wanted to bulldoze me and he tried really hard. And we had a conversation that lasted about an hour. And finally, I ran him off and that was the end of it. But my point is, and you have a couple daughters yourself, they're not that old yet, but my point is, for me, I mean, I kind of think of that scene in Tombstone. It kind of reminds me of this incident where a dad, a husband, an older brother has to step in at certain times and just take care of the problem and not send in a complaint email or not from the sideline say, hey, you should stop that, stop doing that. You just have to get in there and fix it sometimes. So anyway, that's why I think that scene in the movie has some value, especially nowadays. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. My daughters are 12's the oldest, mm-hmm. so I haven't had any dealings with any of that yet, but mm-hmm. I can wait. I am in no hurry.
Well, I know that feeling, but time marches on, and it'll be here before you know it. Truly, it will. It'll be here before you know it. And, you know, and then you blink your eyes and then they've got three kids and married and in the suburbs and you're saying, well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It really is.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful, though. And this is why I think, since we're talking about the idea of the role of a father, the role of a big brother, I think it is, especially in our society, given the ravaging effects of radical feminism and to the extent that many men, I think, have been, to, in a certain sense, kind of feminized, kind of neutralized, emasculated in some cases, it's kind of a lost art. So it seems to me, and again, I'm not pushing the tough guy mode, not at all. I'm not pushing the macho, my way or the highway. I'm not pushing anything like that at all. I'm just saying that there's a time when dad or a big brother or the husband has to step in and put himself between the problem and the people he's protecting.
Yeah,
that's all.
Yeah, it's a saying you don't hear too often anymore. Just be a man.
That's right.
Yeah, that's all right. I got.
Well, you done good, Cyrus. You done good. I have an email from Stuart, and he says, thank you so much for your ministry. I love your morning show. I catch it again on the evening replay. It just shows how relevant and insights your answers are. Thank you. Kind of you. He says, my son-in-law made a statement about that Lucifer is not Satan. It's merely a name given to any who would be a light bearer. This stems from his King James Bible reference to Lucifer in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. It seems this is a half-truth because I read in the notes of the USCCB Bible, that's he's referring to the New American Bible, that, quote, the Vulgate translates as Lucifer, a name applied by the church fathers to Satan. But the USCCB version refers to Morning Star, and my New American Bible uses Day Star, no reference to Lucifer except in the notes. Perhaps to avoid the confusion, Catholic Answers says Satan and Lucifer are one and the same. I am confused. Is Lucifer merely a descriptive name for Satan? Is that why the Catholic Bibles do not use the L word? Thanks for all you do, Stuart. Okay, Stuart, Catholic Answers is entirely right. Lucifer is a name that is ascribed to Satan. And so Satan, the devil, Lucifer, these are all different names or terms that are used to describe this one personage. And we can say of him that he was the chief of all the angels, and he fell, and he became, you might say, the chief or the head of all the fallen angels. And so it's a traditional name. Lucifer would be the anglicized version of the Latin, which means light bearer. And this is where terms like morning star or day star might come into play here. But Catholic Answers is correct, and, you know, wow, big surprise. They have done a lot of work in answering questions like this. So I don't really need to say much more than that, but it's a translation artifact that can be confusing if you don't know the background. So the background simply is that this highly intelligent chief of the angels who fell was blinded by his own pride. And he was beautiful when he was still a good angel. This is what St. Thomas says. He says that the angels were created by God all at once, and instantaneously or immediately after their creation, St. Thomas says, God gave them this test. And the test seems to have been, as best we can tell, that God showed the angels in a flash his plan of salvation. And that presumably would have included the fall of Adam and Eve and the incarnation and God himself becoming a human being. And keep in mind that human beings are lower than angels, and the angels knew that. So here the angels, the trillions upon trillions of them who had just been created by God, are shown that they have to make a decision. They have to make a choice. Are they going to worship Jesus Christ, true God and true man, when they themselves as angels are in a higher level in the created order, higher than human beings? Hebrews chapter 1 gets into this if you want to read a biblical account of it, at least in terms of angels being higher than humans. So as near as we can tell, the essence of that test was that they saw this and they had to either say yes or no. So, you know, fiat mihi secundum verbum tuum, the Latin for what Our Lady said in Luke's gospel, may it be done to me according to thy word. So Adam and Eve were given a test in the garden. Here's this, everything here is for you. Enjoy. I've made all this for your happiness, for your pleasure. Just one thing. See that one tree over there? Yeah. That tree right there, that's the only thing that's not for you. Everything else is for you. That is not for you. Don't touch that. Don't go over and touch that. Don't eat the fruit off that tree. Just leave it alone. Everything else is for you, but not that. So what do? They go over there and they touch that. They failed their test. So the angels had their own test, and as I was describing, those who fell were immediately banished from the presence of God, and those who passed the test, the good angels, the majority of them, thankfully, they were immediately ushered into the beatific vision. They then became fully confirmed for all eternity in grace and seeing God face to face. And the reverse, of course, is true for the fallen angels. Sometimes people say, well, how could they sin? I mean, they see God. They're in heaven. How could they sin? Well, they weren't in heaven yet. That's how. In this instantaneous moment where they had to make their choice, that's what happened. So the bad angels never made it to heaven. They never got in. And the good angels went into heaven as soon as they passed that test. It's interesting, and it has a real-world effect on you. Angels, both good and bad, have a role to play in all of our lives, as the Holy Bible says. So let's be attentive to them. Let's ignore the bad angels and cultivate a good relationship with the good ones. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Interesting musical choice, Cyrus. I like that.
Yeah, you got me in the mood for these old westerns.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
It's a classic.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen it. Yul Brynner was in that, I think.
So we all know you're the good. So what does that leave for you? Where does that leave me?
And where does that leave Drew? Come on, man. Yeah.
Oh, that's too funny.
Yeah. I've got something on a little more on the serious side I want to share.
Okay.
Okay. This is something from a Catholic priest who is a member of the Vatican Commission. It's the Vatican International Theological Commission. His name is Father Thomas Wynandi. I hope I'm saying it correctly. He said recently, he said, and this is an article that's taken from Life News. I tweeted it. So if you want to see this, the headline is from a member of the Vatican International Theological Commission, pro-abortion Catholic politicians are using and so abusing the Eucharist for seemingly political purposes to present themselves as devout Catholics. So if you want to read this, you'll find it on my Twitter feed. It's right there at the top. And so here's a little bit from the article, courtesy of Life News. It's not the Catholic Church, but pro-abortion politicians who profess to be Catholic who are politicizing communion, according to Reverend Thomas Wynandi, who wrote this month at The Catholic Thing. Wynandi, a Capuchin Franciscan and a member of the Vatican International Theological Commission, said pro-abortion Catholic politicians, and this is a quote from him, are using and so abusing the Eucharist for seemingly political purposes to present themselves as devout Catholics. An intense debate within the Catholic Church, leaders are mulling whether President Joe Biden, a radical pro-abortion Democrat who professes to be a devout Catholic, and other public leaders who support abortion, whether they should continue to be allowed to participate in the Eucharist. Some say pro-abortion Catholic politicians are causing scandal and harming their souls by participating in communion. I don't know why they say participating. You don't participate in communion, you receive communion. In any case, they're harming their souls, et cetera, by receiving communion while openly defying church teachings, while others contend that denying communion to a politician like Biden would politicize, quote unquote, the sacrament. In his essay, Father Wynandi says that pro-abortion politicians are the ones bringing politics into the church. Some bishops argue that such Catholic politicians should not be refused communion, for to do so would be to politicize the Eucharist. The refusal, and this is Father Wynandi speaking here, the refusal on the part of bishops or priests would indeed cause a political and media fuss, and prudence may suggest in certain circumstances that communion should not be refused. However, he says, the bishops also must consider the scandal that these politicians are causing as well as the integrity of the sacrament. He says, what should most concern the church is that such Catholic politicians do not simply hold many things that are in opposition to the Catholic faith, but they also actively attack through the laws they propose and enact. They attack the Catholic Church, the very church to which they claim devotion. The report that this is drawing upon says, Father Wynandi said that defenders of such politicians say that receiving communion is a sign of devoutness despite the contradictions between professed Catholicism and promoting abortion, same-sex relationships, or other causes. Ironically, Father Wynandi says, such Catholic politicians do the very thing that no truly devout Catholic would ever do. The very, quote-unquote, devout action they perform, that of receiving Holy Communion, is an enacted declaration that they lack authentic Catholic devotion. He said, no one is fooled by this charade, except maybe the self-deluded politician. Now, there's more, and there are links, for example, to a statement from Archbishop Joseph Naumann. He's the Archbishop of Kansas City in Kansas. He chairs the U.S. Bishops Committee on Pro-Life Activities. And Archbishop Naumann publicly said that these Catholic politicians who advocate for abortion are, quote, creating scandal by encouraging others to do evil. He's exactly right. There's a link here also to, let's see, is it in this article? No, but if you scroll down one or two scrolls below this one, I have links to some letters that were recently released, for example, by Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco, Bishop Olmsted of Phoenix. Bishop Olmsted says, "Woe to us bishops if we do not speak clearly about the grave evil of abortion and the consequences of any Catholic who participates in the act or publicly supports it by word or action." And that was a statement by Bishop Olmsted, who's the Bishop of Phoenix, in public support of the letter that was recently released by Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco. Bishop Vasha, I think I mentioned him, he's the, yesterday, I believe, he's the Bishop of Santa Rosa. He, too, came out in a public statement supporting and praising Archbishop Cordiglione's pastoral letter. And that pastoral letter, by the way, is called Before I Formed You in the Womb, I Knew You. So there is quite a bit out there from bishops who are speaking up publicly on this issue, and they are clarifying what seems to be, for some people, a murky issue. They just don't seem to understand it. So they're clarifying it, which is great. And I would encourage you, especially if you find yourself puzzled as to why would it, like a self-professed Catholic who happens to be a politician, who happens to be in favor of abortion, who happens to legislate and protect and promote at every step abortion, why would that person receive Holy Communion? Well, that's what these bishops and archbishops are talking about. So it would be well worth your time, I believe, to just acquaint yourself with what they're saying. And maybe you yourself are already dialed in and you understand this, but maybe there's someone in your family. Maybe there's a fellow parishioner or somebody that you interact with who just doesn't seem to get this. These are some articles that you can give to that person, or just text them, text a link, and it's even easier that way. And you'll find all of them, one after the other, on my Twitter feed. I think they're very important. 888-914-9149. Remember when I reported, I don't know, this is going back into last summer, but I reported that same day, I think it was, that the Mission Church in San Gabriel, so the San Gabriel Mission, that it was torched by an arsonist. You may remember that. And it was completely destroyed. And this was one of the missions in the mission system that were founded by, among others, St. Junipero Serra back in the 1700s. He was one of the founding fathers of the state of California. He created a system of these missions. He and his helpers, I mean, he had help. But I think it runs to a total of about 21 missions, if I'm not mistaken, up and down from San Diego all the way up to Sonoma. And these missions were centers of commerce. They were places of protection and refuge where people could gather in the event of some danger, could be attacking, marauding tribes who would come and kill local people or enslave them. So the missions were a place of safety. They were also a place of worship because the priests would celebrate Mass there. They would give people the sacraments. And were the missions entirely free from controversy? No, obviously not. And as we judge them through the lens of our 21st century wokeness, so to speak, the conclusions people draw nowadays are not always favorable. But regardless, the missions were a great asset to the people, both the indigenous peoples as well as the Spaniards and others who happened to be traveling through, for all the reasons I just mentioned and many more. And one of the other things is that the indigenous peoples were able to learn trades and crafts. They learned how to paint. They did glass blowing. They learned how to work metal and tan hides and work with other things and tools and implements that they had never even known about before. So it was the mission system was a way to enable them to rise as high as they could be because they had lots of additional knowledge and they had these skills that they presumably would never have had a chance to learn before or after it. So that is one of the missions, and this is in San Gabriel, so real close to our beloved Carmelite sisters in Alhambra, just to the east of them. So that fire, back in July of last year, it completely destroyed the rooftop, most of the interior of the mission. And it was actually at that time undergoing renovations to mark the upcoming 250th anniversary. This is an article by the Associated Press, by the way. Thankfully, nobody was hurt in the fire, but they finally caught the guy who they think did it. His name is John David Corey, being reported publicly in the Associated Press, 57 years old, faces multiple counts, including arson of an inhabited structure and first-degree burglary. This according to the L.A. County District Attorney's Office. They don't know yet if he has an attorney who will represent him. Prosecutors contend that Corey broke into the mission and started the fire, which spread to the roof and along the length of the church. The flames spared the altar and historic paintings. Other artifacts had been stored elsewhere in the church as it underwent renovations. The coronavirus pandemic forced masses online, but the church building will resume indoor services in about a little less than 2 weeks. The loss to the mission, according to District Attorney George Gascon, the loss to the mission was in the millions of dollars, but the loss to the community is immeasurable. He says the church was the fourth in a string of the Catholic missions established across California by St. Junipero Serra. I'm adding the word saint to that. While many credit Serra with spreading Catholicism along the West Coast, he has long been a symbol of oppression among indigenous activists. And that's kind of getting to the point that I was making earlier, that there is mixed opinions on whether he was a good guy or a bad guy. But I contend that St. Junipero Serra was a very good guy and that he did many very good things. A little detail on him. He was from a wealthy family in Spain, and he could have had a very comfortable life there in law or medicine, or he could have done just about anything because he was very intelligent. But he really wanted to go serve God and serve the people in the missions. And at that time, the mid-1700s, the missions that Spain was primarily involved with were in the New World. And so he knew about the activities of the friars and other priests who were going to what is now Mexico, for example, and what is now California to try to evangelize the peoples there. So he went into religious life, and after having been I think it was in Mallorca, if I'm not mistaken, either Menorca or Mallorca. He eventually got permission from his religious superiors to go to Mexico. But when he got to Mexico, they recognized how intelligent he was and what a good teacher he was. So they put him into teaching work for years. So he was teaching in the university in I believe he was in what is now Mexico City. And there, too, he could have had a very comfortable life. He would have had food and wine and shelter and, you know, better clothing and all of the amenities that would accrue to somebody who had a nice life in academia like that. But he really, really wanted to go into the missions. So his religious superiors eventually, they gave him permission to go. And so he went. And one of the things that's striking about St. Junipero Serra is that he walked everywhere. Everybody else, for the most part, was on horseback. And he could have ridden a horse had he wanted to, or he could have been in a horse-drawn cart or something like that. But as a penance for the people and also for his own sake, he chose to walk everywhere. Now, those of you who live in California or have visited California, you know that's a very big state. And to walk is, you'd be walking forever. And that's what he did. He walked up and down and back and forth and year after year. And what really made this, I think, heroic was that early on in his missionary activity, Junipero Serra had been bitten by a bug. It probably was a mosquito, could have been a spider. And it left an open sore. And I'm guessing he probably scratched at it, but it never actually healed. So imagine a sore that turns into something more than a sore, and now it's like an open wound. And they didn't have medicine in those days like we do. You couldn't just pop into a Walgreens and get some Bactine spray or anything like that. There was nothing. You know, maybe you pour a little water over it from time to time, but there was nothing to do for it. And if it made you feel really bad and if you were in a lot of pain, there was no painkiller that you could take. There was no aspirin or anything like that. So back to St. Junipero Serra. So he's spending the best years of his life in the heat, in the dust, in the danger, in the toil of bringing the word of God, the message of Jesus Christ, to these indigenous folk. And he's got this wound on his leg that won't heal. He's in pain, and he still he chooses to walk. And his doing that was a form of penance. And it was also a way of saying, I don't want any special treatment. I don't want any special like upgrades or anything like that. I'm here to serve Jesus Christ and to serve these people, and I'm just going to keep it simple. So part of his heroic virtue was to live with suffering on an ongoing, daily, minute-by-minute basis and not stop working. You know, you get a headache, I got to lie down. I'm sorry, I can't work right now. He just kept going. He just kept going and going and going. And that's a big part of why he was declared a saint. I'll be right back with hour two of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Please stay right there. La, 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 la.